thanks to our technical and IT capabilities.
Press TV may lose momentum with every interference, at least temporarily, but it continues publishing its content round the clock on any platform possible, namely Twitter and Instagram. But it also distributes its content on its own IPTV called YourMedium.com. Given repeated censorship attacks by the US tech giants Google's YouTube service. In 2021, with the sixth and seventh rounds of the Vienna talks to lift sanctions off this country, Iran's PressTV's.com domain, among others, was seized by the US. That was on June the 22nd of the same year. PressTV.com was not the only target, like I said. More than 30 outlets with links to the anti-Israel resistance movements were shut down. Although country domains aren't easy to block, because that would arouse international objection to undermining countries' sovereignty. So the US's act will have been a wasted effort. Iran simply continued its work on its .ir domain, so you can still reach content on www.presstv.ir. Well, Iran continues to seek ways round sabotage of its message dissemination. Farah's anniversaries go, till next time. Thanks for sharing this occasion with us, but do tune in again at the same times next week and each week after, as we'll be back with different topics.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Experts say Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony of a president lunging at a Secret Service agent's throat is going to loom very large in US history. We have prepared for you an article written by David Smith. The piece is titled Angry, Violent, Reckless. Testimony paints shocking portrait of Trump. Donald Trump lunged at a Secret Service agent's throat. He threw dishes during temper tantrums, and he wanted metal detectors taken away so his fans could march with guns and knives. An astonishing portrait of Donald Trump as an unhinged and personally violent president emerged at Tuesday, 28th of June's hearing on the Congressional Committee investigating last year's attack on the U.S. Capitol. Even for a country and a political press corps long used to norm-shattering of the Trump years, the picture painted of Donald Trump at the surprise hearing was a shock to the system. The 6th of January panel had promised new revelations, and it did not disappoint. Michael Beschloss, a presidential historian, told MSNBC Network, "Never before in American history have we ever seen credible testimony this shocking against the President of the United States before Congress." Michael Beschloss added, "This is a day that is going to loom very large in American history." The star witness at the hastily arranged hearing was Cassidy Hutchinson, an aide to the then White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows. Hutchinson described how Donald Trump wanted to go to the U.S. Capitol with his supporters on 6th of January 2021 after giving a fiery speech that urged them to fight for him. Cassidy Hutchinson, 25, testified to the panel that Tony Ornato, the White House Deputy Chief of Staff, told her that Donald Trump had a very strong, very angry response when informed he would be driven back to the White House instead. Trump told a Secret Service agent, "I'm the effing president. Take me up to the Capitol now." When the agent refused, Donald Trump tried to seize the steering wheel of the presidential vehicle. His security detail, Robert Engel, grabbed his arm and said, "Sir, you need to take your hand off the steering wheel. We're going back to the West Wing. We're not going to the Capitol." Cassidy Hutchinson told the hearing that Donald Trump then used his free hand to lunge towards the Engel's clavicle. She added, "Engel has never contradicted the account." The committee also heard how Donald Trump erupted in fury on 1st of December after his Attorney General William Barr gave an interview to the Associated Press saying there was no evidence of widespread election fraud. Cassidy Hutchinson recalled seeing a shattered porcelain plate and ketchup on the wall of a dining room at the White House. The valet had articulated that the president was extremely angry at the Attorney General's Associated Press interview and had thrown his lunch at the wall. "This was not an isolated incident," she added. "There are several times I was aware of him either throwing dishes or flipping the tablecloth to let all the contents of the table go onto the floor and break or go everywhere." The account demonstrated that the coup attempt on 6th of January 2021 was no anomaly but on brand for a man who seems to regard violence as sport. Donald Trump has long been prominent in the world of boxing and wrestling, and in a 2013 interview said of organized crime, "I have met on occasion a few of those people. They happen to be very nice people." During his election campaign in 2016, Donald Trump told one rally crowd, "If you see somebody getting ready to throw a tomato, knock the crap out of them. Would you? I promise you I will pay for the legal fees." At another rally, he said of a protester, "Get him out. Try not to hurt him. If you do, I'll defend you in court. Don't worry about it." Earlier at Thursday's hearing, Cassidy Hutchinson told the House of Representatives Select Committee that Donald Trump was told that people at the 6th of January 2021 rally had guns, knives and other weapons, and was disappointed at them being turned away. She said, "I overheard the president say something to the effect of, 'I don't care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me. Take the mags or magnetometers away. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here.'" After the session, Jamie Raskin, a member of the House Select Committee, told reporters, "We had the President of the United States upset that the Secret Service and other authorities were using metal detectors for people entering his rally, and he wanted those taken down so everyone could enter, including people who were armed, and there were official reports of people carrying AR-15 machine guns on that day." There was more. Cassidy Hutchinson testified that as the mob hunted Mike Pence, Mark Meadows told the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, that Donald Trump was untroubled. She said, "I remember Pat Cipollone saying, 'They're literally calling for the vice president to be hung.'" And Mark Meadows had responded something to the effect of, "You heard him, Pat. He thinks Mike deserves it. He doesn't think they're doing anything wrong." At the end of the session, Liz Cheney, the vice chairwoman of the House Select Committee, showed that witnesses have been receiving calls and messages from people close to Donald Trump, telling them that he knows they will remain loyal in depositions. Michael Beschloss tweeted, "Why does this sound like a hearing investigating a mobster?" It all proved that, despite countless newspaper reports and books, the 4 years of Donald Trump's presidency still have the power to make jaws drop. How bad his critics think it was, there is always another revelation around the corner and shows it was even worse. Perhaps most incredible of all, the man who sought to overthrow American democracy is the frontrunner for the Republican Party presidential nomination in 2024, for the moment at least. Mehdi Hassan, a broadcaster and journalist, posted on Twitter, "Listening to this hearing today is yet another reminder that there is no aspect of the Trump presidency that could be written by a television writer in a writing room. It would be ridiculed as too unbelievable and too unrealistic and too crazy. But it all happened. It all happened in real life."
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Who knew that some American doctors can tell so much just by the color of your skin? If your skin happens to be the color black, doctors believe you do not feel as much pain as white people do. And if you are not white, American doctors may think that you are probably lying about your condition and pain, that you will not receive the same treatment even with the same insurance coverage. African and Native American women have been known to have been sterilized without consent in America. The way Native and African Americans have been treated by medical practitioners in the U.S. has caused them to fear and distrust the so-called healer.
Fear of the Healer.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. And in today's episode, we'll discuss medical racism, how minorities in the U.S. have been treated by the health industry historically and in contemporary times. Why do so many African Americans distrust the U.S. health system, especially when it comes to vaccines? And how does medical racism affect the overall well-being and health of minorities in America? As usual, we're pleased to have our two guests on our show, Dr. Claire M. Cohen, MD, staff child and adolescent psychiatrist at Southwood Hospital in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Life Malcolm, community organizer out of Tampa Bay, Florida. Stay tuned.
A visit to the hospital or the doctor's office can be comforting, especially if you're white and living in the United States. But many Black African Americans have reported the opposite. Their visit to the ER, hospital, or doctor's office can often be intimidating and stressful.
Now, according to Dr. Jennifer McCurdy from the MSU College of Human Medicine Center for Bioethics and Justice, white people go through life unimpeded. They don't think about spaces because the spaces were made for them and by them. They are white spaces. Now, the rules are made for white people by white people. And as a result, these same spaces can be unwelcoming and at times accompanied with fear for African Americans and other minorities. So, what is medical racism?
So medical racism is a systemic and widespread racism against people of color, and especially Black people within the medical system in the United States. And it includes both racism in our society that makes Black people and other people of color less healthy, as well as disparities in healthcare coverage and biases held by healthcare workers that lead them to diagnose and treat people of color, especially Black people, differently when they're their patients.
So historically, different racial and ethnic groups in America have suffered and endured immense hardship, discrimination, and even torture under the U.S. medical system. In the 1960s and 70s, Native American women were forcibly sterilized by the Indian Health Service. Now, physicians in the 1970s sterilized more than 25% of Native American women of childbearing age. Some reports indicate that the number was much, much higher. Black and Latino women were also targets of these appalling actions.
U.S. pharmaceutical companies also tend to test some of their dangerous drugs on Africans instead of testing it in their own country. Famously, Pfizer, one of the world's largest pharmaceutical companies, tested their Trovan experimental antibiotic in Kano, Nigeria in 1996, where there was an outbreak of meningitis.
Now testing on just 200 children, Nigeria's Kano officials said 50 of them died and others developed mental and physical deformities. Pfizer later paid the Kano state and some of the families of the victims in 2009 in a very discreet out-of-court settlement. So why are private companies testing their drugs in Africa?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, the private sector is, you know, that you have colonizers in the private sector and colonizers who operate in the state, you know, as state officials. So that's no real difference. You know, pharmaceutical companies have their material interests, mostly financial interests, tied to the colonial state, the colonial mode of production. And so they do experiments on Africans and other colonized people, just like the government, you know, the state does as well. So, yeah, you know, it's just two different sides of the same coin.
Harriet A. Washington, author of the award-winning 2007 book called Medical Apartheid, has stated that the dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present has explained how the actions of white medical practitioners towards African Americans has resulted in their distrust and fear from doctors. One of the reasons the African American communities were among those who were reluctant to receive COVID vaccines was this history of distrust.
As African Americans, we've been abused for so long, consistently by the system. Why should we trust it? Why should we go to one ill? And that's iatrophobia. That's a fear of the healer. African-American babies were no longer economically valuable. And African-Americans themselves had gone from being a resource to a nuisance.
Another example of crimes against African-Americans was the Tuskegee syphilis study. Between 1932 and 1972, the United States Public Health Service and the CDC conducted a study on 399 African-Americans with syphilis and 201 others without the disease as the control group. Now, the chosen men were poor and they were promised free medical care. They were never informed of their illness, and when treatment became available, they were only given placebos in order to track their full progression of the disease.
So the history of the treatment of black people has been that they've always been, their health has not been valued, their physical integrity has not been valued, and they've been used as experimental, routinely as for experimentation in medicine. The two most famous examples are the Tuskegee experiment, which went from the 50s into the 70s, in which black men were told they were being treated for syphilis, but instead were actually given syphilis and just given fake treatment and watched to see what would happen to them. So all these black men that thought they were being treated were actually not being treated as an experiment to see what happens with people who have syphilis and aren't treated. The other famous example is the whole field of gynecology. There are a lot of the procedures for treating problem pregnancies and treating gynecological problems were developed by experimenting on black women with no anesthesia, very painful experiments, and experiments that ruined their reproductive tract, making them unable to have children. Many of these were created by the physician called the father of gynecology, experimenting on black women. And then he would take the results of what he learned from these painful, humiliating, and damaging experiments and use them to successfully treat white women who were having problem pregnancies or other problems that made it hard for them to have children.
As a result of this study, 28 of the participants died from syphilis because it was left untreated. 100 more died from related complications, at least 40 of their spouses were also diagnosed with it, and as a result passed down to 19 of their children. The men were told that the experiment was only going to last for 6 months, but it was extended to 40 years. It was only when the study was leaked to the press in 1972 that the government was forced to stop the project.
When you talk about the vaccines, of course, most of us know about the whole idea of the Tuskegee experiment, and we know that everything that happens in everything that happens under colonial domination happens for the benefit of the colonizer, and often to the detriment, if not always to the detriment of the colonized. So, you know, these vaccines, that, you know, in my community, it's a whole bunch of radio commercials, a whole bunch of billboards and newspaper ads and stuff saying, get the vaccine, get the vaccine, get the vaccine. They push that stuff because the colonizer wants to see what it does to the colonized before they know whether they should use it for themselves. And so we don't trust them because we're intelligent, and history's shown us that they'll use colonizers will use colonized people as medical experiments. So that's another material basis for the distrust.
Medical racism is definitely not a phenomena of the past. In 2016, research conducted by the University of Virginia found that disparities in pain management can be attributed in part to bias. A substantial number of white medical students hold false beliefs about biological differences between black and white people. More than half of medical students surveyed believe that blacks feel less pain than whites.
When I was in medical school, they were very open about it. A lot of the drugs that we use to treat cancer, for example, a lot of the vaccines that have been developed, a lot of these medicines are first tested in Africa, and also not as much anymore, but also in black community, on black unsuspecting black people in black communities. So they're tested to look for the side effects, the problems, whether they work. And then only once they're clear whether it would be okay to use in human, do they then do trials in voluntary and white volunteers.
Another study published in JAMA Pediatrics in 2015 found that black children were 80% less likely than white children to receive opioid for their pain. The authors of the study used data from the National Hospital Ambulatory Medical Care Survey from 2003 to 2010 on about 1 million patients aged 21 or younger who were diagnosed with appendicitis in an emergency room.
Based on our colonial status, the U.S. government and its medical professionals, generally speaking, treat us as expendable, as experimental. They know, these medical professionals know that many Africans in the U.S. are poor, so they'll run these commercials and these ads that say, ask your doctor for this drug, take this test, get this vaccine. And of course, they know, the medical professionals, the people who push these commercials know that many of Africans in this country are uneducated, uninformed, poor, you know, desperate, and illiterate, you know, not just, I mean, beyond uninformed, many of us can't even read for ourselves so we can get an understanding and become informed. And these medical professionals take advantage of that and create this fear, like you'll see in every African community in the U.S., we got the most AIDS, the most high blood pressure in the commercials to say it. And so now we're scared and so they push their experiments on us, make us guinea pigs, willing guinea pigs, because of our ignorance and fear.
Now, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, black babies are dying twice as often as white babies. The overall infant mortality rate in African and Native Americans in the United States is more than twice of that of white Americans. So it is quite disturbing that another study in 2020 showed that black babies die at three times the rate of white newborns during their initial hospital stays. But when black doctors care for black babies, their mortality rate was cut in half.
So, for example, a lot of your white medical colleagues are going to think and studies document this, think that black people have a higher pain tolerance than white people, which isn't true. Well, I had a professor once tell me that black mothers don't care as much for their children, which, of course, is not true and very hurtful. I had a black professor when I was in medical school stand up in front of the class and say that stood up in front of the whole medical class and said that he didn't think any of the black students there deserved to be there because black people are not as smart as white people and they shouldn't be in medical school. The same professor, yeah, well, anyway, so I could tell you a lot of stories. When I got into my residency and internship, I could tell you lots of stories of just really hurtful things that were said, seeing people start to not treat patients, make assumptions about patients, that they're all drug addicts.
During the pandemic, African Americans received the least vaccines compared to other races in the United States. Experts believe that the main reason for their reluctance in getting vaccinated was because of the historical and ongoing discrimination and racism in black communities. Behavior toward African Americans has caused mistrust towards healthcare and healthcare providers. What is the main reason of the distrust towards the U.S. health system?
That's a good question. I would say that to answer the question, frankly, bluntly, and tersely, the reason why Africans distrust the healthcare system is because we're intelligent. No, there's no intelligent slave, no intelligent colonized person that would, no intelligent slave would trust the enslaver, and no intelligent colonized would trust the colonizer. You know, the enslaver's sole existence is based on exploiting the colonized or the enslaved, and the colonizer's sole existence is, you know, based on exploiting the colonized. So, we intelligent enough not to trust the colonizer and the enslaver.
African American communities have endlessly been under systemic inequities and medical and structural racism. They are therefore harmed disproportionately. Studies show that physicians spend less time with African American patients, and when they are seen, they often ignore or dismiss concerns. These patients are more likely to be poverty-stricken in areas with higher pollution, low-quality education and housing, and fewer healthcare facilities.
And how does it impact Black people? I'll use the example of breast cancer in Black women. So Black women die at way higher proportion from breast cancer than white women. And when a lot of studies looking at why have noted that one of the problems is that Black women are less likely or come much later to treatment than white women when their cancer is much further along. And then another recent study in JAMA looked at why is it that Black women are coming much later to treatment. And for more than half of those women, it's because they didn't have the insurance coverage that allowed them to come to treatment early. Either they had no insurance or they had an insurance policy that has such a high deductible. That's the money you pay to go to see the doctor. That's the money you have to put out front. I'm sorry. That's the money you have to put out before your insurance will even start paying, that they couldn't go.
Now, the picture of racism and inequality in the United States is so grim that a nationwide poll by the Undefeated and the Kaiser Family Foundation, the KFF, found that 7 out of 10 African Americans believe that people are treated completely unfairly based on race or ethnicity when they seek medical care. Now, this feeling has been intensified by the COVID-19 pandemic, which was disproportionately affecting Black lives, both physically and economically.
Whether racism comes into play with the distribution of health care, I don't know, but certainly all health care providers in the U.S. can tell the difference between, people. You know, they can see whether a person looks, male or female, whether a person looks white, Caucasian, or European, or Black, or Negro, or African, or however you feel like, and they can see it.
The other issue that escalates the medical racism problem in the United States is the very low number of African American doctors in the country. Only about 2.6% of the country's doctors in 2019 and 7.3% of students enrolled in medical school in 2020 identified as Black or African American. This is while more than 13% of the overall population of the country consists of African Americans.
My experience mirrors what happens to people. So when I was in med school, even before I became a psychiatrist, there's disproportionately less Black people in med school because, as you know, higher education in the United States is barely subsidized, and people go into debt with loans going getting higher education. So when I was going to med school, the average debt was I came out of med school with over $100,000 in debt. Now I understand people come out with $250,000 in debt from med school.
The overall health of the African Americans in the United States is much worse than whites. They have higher rates of diabetes, hypertension, and heart disease, and Black children have a 500% higher death rate from asthma compared to white children. This is not only about receiving medical attention. It's also based on living conditions, access to fresh food and outdoor space, and the quality of air, among other factors.
African people die at, I think our average longevity age is something like in the 70s, right? And of course, as you know, based on the gun violence and other stuff in our community, cancers, what have you, like we die much sooner, much younger than 70. And all of this death, everything that is wrong with every African who's sick from sucking cigarettes, every African who's sick from drinking liquor and beer, every African who's sick from cocaine and other drugs, every African who's, got the high blood pressure and all this stuff comes from colonial domination, because it's not us who puts the cigarette commercials on TV, who puts the liquor stores on the corner, who puts the ham hocks in the grocery stores, make it the only meal we can eat. It's the colonizer who sets up the whole, commerce in our community. And so the medicinal problem is directly tied to the colonial domination. We would not be sick, as sick as we are, if we controlled our own lives and were not victims of colonial domination. And so, yeah, it's up to every African or other colonized person to fight back against colonial domination so that we can be healthier and don't have to worry about, whether we call it race or colonialism, other people controlling our health and our longevity.
Medical racism is not just about a lack of medical facilities in neighborhoods that are predominantly African-American, or that they receive less care or are treated differently. It's about the racial beliefs in American society. How even medical students who are supposed to be educated think of African Americans as less than humans. Now, when these belief systems still exist, actions and regulations to curb racism will only be superficial and ineffective. And that was the show, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. And do join us again next week for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with the concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. Imam brought the people to the arena, showed them the way, kept them in the arena and steered them away from despair and hopelessness. As for his school of thought, principles and goals, if we wish to briefly explain the foundation of Imam's school of thought and revolution, we must say that the foundation for all his activities was rising up for the cause of God. The goal was to rise for the cause of God. This is what he wrote in his youth at the office of the late Waziri Yazdi, God's greetings be upon him. Say, O Prophet, I advise you to do only one thing, rise up for the sake of God, individually or in pairs. This is Quran chapter 34, verse 46.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
This uprising for the cause of God is firmly rooted in the Quran. This has been mentioned in this ayah of Surah Saba, or in the ayah which says, "And stand in true devotion to God," chapter 2, verse 238, which is in Holy Surah Al-Baqarah. Another ayah is in Surah Al-Mudathir, which was sent down in the beginning of Ba'tha. O you covered up in your cloak, arise and warn all, chapter 74, verses 1 and 2. This is what rising for the cause of God means. Of course, rising for the cause of God might occur in different ways in every era. Rising for the cause of God does not always take on a single form, but there is only one goal behind it, and that is the establishment of the truth, the administration of justice, and the promotion of spirituality. This holds true at all times. This means the establishment of the truth. Rising for the cause of God might take place in the form of military fight at one time and at another time. It might take on a significant form, and at yet another time, it might take on a political form. But the purpose of rising for the cause of God must establish the truth.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
In the limelight.
The shot came midway through the speech. Reparation, boomed Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's firebrand president, to the cheers of farmers, working students who had gathered in the crowd. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Constant Mahout, Catherine Porter, Salam Gebrekidan, and Matt Apuzzo. The piece is titled, "A Haitian President Tried to Hold France to Account for Its Years of Exploitation. He Soon Found Himself Ousted from Power." The shock came midway through the speech. Reparation, boomed Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's firebrand president, to the cheers of the farmers, workers and students who had gathered in the crowd. The French ambassador to Haiti, sitting on stage, hid his alarm behind an awkward smile. He knew Mr. Aristide well enough to expect barbs at Haiti's former French colonizers and slave masters. But on that day, on 7th of April 2003, the president suddenly started calling for reparations, a bombshell that became a hallmark of his presidency, and diplomats now concede part of his undoing. We had to try to defuse it, the French ambassador to Haiti, Yves Goudil, said of Mr. Aristide's call for reparations, calling it an explosive. With his remarks, Jean-Bertrand Aristide tried to excavate a history that remains all but buried in France. Long after Haitians threw off their shackles, beat Napoleon's forces and won their independence 2 centuries ago, France came back with warships and an unheard-of demand that the people of Haiti pay astounding amounts of money to their former slave masters or face war again. Haiti became the first and only nation in the world to pay reparations to its former slave masters and their descendants for generations. According to a New York Times analysis of thousands of pages of archival documents, it shipped the equivalent of hundreds of millions of dollars to France, setting off a cycle of perpetual debt that sapped Haiti's ability to build a nation for more than 100 years. Yet, to this day, that history is not taught in French schools, and many of the country's most prominent aristocratic families are unaware that their ancestors kept collecting payments from Haiti's poorest people long after the end of slavery in Haiti. Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's first democratically elected president after decades of dictatorship, wanted France to do far more than acknowledge its past. He wanted restitutions from Paris. What beautiful schools, universities and hospitals we'll be able to build for our children, he told the crowd. How much food we will have in abundance. The consequences were immediate and lasting. In interviews, a dozen French and Haitian political figures recounted how a worried France worked quickly and doggedly to stifle Jean-Bertrand Aristide's call for reparations before siding with his opponents and collaborating with the United States to remove Aristide from power. France and the United States have long said that Jean-Bertrand Aristide's call for restitution had nothing to do with his ouster, that he had taken an autocratic turn, lost control of the country, and was spirited into exile to prevent Haiti, already heaving with turmoil, from careening into chaos. But France's ambassador to Haiti at the time, Thierry Burkhard, conceded in an interview that France and the United States had effectively orchestrated a coup d'etat against Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and that his abrupt removal from power was probably a bit about his call for reparations from France as well. It made our job easier to dismiss the reparations claim without Jean-Bertrand Aristide in office, Thierry Burkhard noted. The showdown underscores how, 2 centuries after France forced the Haitians to pay their former slave masters for the liberty they had already won in battle, the effects continue to ripple through the politics of both countries. By calling for restitution, Haiti, a nation born from what historians called the world's most successful slave rebellion, struck at France's national identity as a beacon of human rights and threatened to inspire other nations with historical grievances against France to follow its lead, nations in the Caribbean and in Africa. We were very disdainful of Haiti, the French ambassador Yves Godwell recalled. What I think we will never forgive Haiti for, deep down, is that it is the country that beat us. Even after Jean-Bertrand Aristide's removal of power in 2004, the calls for restitution have continued to reverberate, leading to a stunning concession more than a decade later by François Hollande, France's former president, who referred to the money Haiti was forced to hand over as ransom of independence. Since then, scholars have increasingly explored the history of Haiti's payments. Just this past December, at a conference on the grounds of the French Finance Ministry, one of the most prominent French historians on relations between the two countries, Jean-François Brière, called the payments a form of meta-slavery that prevented Haiti from breaking free of France long after independence. All French people are affected by the nation's past in Haiti, said Jean-Marc Ayrault, a former French prime minister. Yet, Ayrault said, French students don't learn about it and few officials discuss it. It's never taught in France, he said. It's never explained. Mr. Yves Godwell, France's former ambassador to Haiti, wanted to negotiate. Jean-Bertrand Aristide's sudden call for restitution was a political hand grenade, he feared, threatening to embarrass France on the world stage and rip apart relations between the two countries. Yet, Jean-Bertrand Aristide's stance was not unreasonable, he recalled thinking. He wasn't wrong to say how much harm it had done to his country, Mr. Godwell said of France's history in Haiti, and to ask France for compensation in turn. The former French ambassador to Haiti, Yves Godwell, said he urged the French government at the time to open discussions with Haiti to help defuse the situation, but was firmly rejected. I didn't understand how we could be so stupid, Mr. Godwell said. Jean-Bertrand Aristide, a polarizing figure who rose to office as a champion of the poor, knew his campaign was contentious and had timed it for maximal impact. He announced his demand on the 200th anniversary of the death of Toussaint Louverture, the Haitian revolutionary leader seized by Napoleon Bonaparte's forces and carted off to prison in France, where he died without a trial. Why, after 200 years, is Haiti this impoverished? Jean-Bertrand Aristide said in a recent interview at his home in a suburb of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince. One of the reasons, he said, was the enormous amount of money that Haiti has been forced to hand over to France for generations, a heavy burden often called the independence debt. Mr. Aristide uncovered this history only after he had already been ousted from office the first time, his aide said, when a military coup d'etat deposed him in 1991 and forced him into exile in the United States. He began immersing himself in the growing scholarship on a history that even as Haiti's president, he knew little about. After the Americans helped restore him to power, he was re-elected in 2000 and intensified his research into Haiti's past. He would call many times asking for more information, recalled Dr. Francis Saint-Hubert, a Haitian physician who had studied the links between the abysmal state of public health in Haiti and the money siphoned off by France. On the bicentennial anniversary, Jean-Bertrand Aristide upped the political ante by declaring the precise amount he said France owed Haiti. $21,685,135,571. French diplomats and some Haitians mocked the multi-billion-dollar figure as a misguided publicity stunt by a demagogue trying to maintain his grip on power. A group of 130 Haitian intellectuals denounced the restitution campaign as a desperate attempt to distract attention from the Jean-Bertrand Aristide government's totalitarian drift, incompetence and corruption. A French foreign ministry spokesman said France did not need to take lessons from Haiti's leaders. But a New York Times analysis of the long-term damage done by sending enormous sums of money to France shows that Haiti's losses may have been surprisingly close to Jean-Bertrand Aristide's figure of $21.68 billion. In fact, his estimate may have been a bit modest. The New York Times scoured thousands of pages of archival government documents to determine how much Haiti sent to France over the course of generations, not just in official payments to former slaveholders, but also for a loan to help pay them. The New York Times found that Haiti paid France a total of $560 million in today's dollars. But that only begins to account for the loss. With the help of 15 leading economies from around the world, we modelled what might have happened if that money had gone into the Haitian economy, rather than being siphoned off to France without getting any goods or any services in return. The New York Times' estimates found that over time, the payments to France cost Haiti from $21 billion to $115 billion in lost economic growth. Put in perspective, that is anywhere from 1 to 8 times the size of Haiti's entire economy in 2020. We were building a path to the truth, Jean-Bertrand Aristide said in the interview, without being told the outcome of the New York Times' analysis.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The Iranian city of Sardasht in West Azerbaijan province is the third city after Japan's Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which became the target of weapons of mass destruction in the world. In June 1987, Iraqi warplanes dropped mustard gas bombs on Sardasht in 2 separate bombing runs on 4 residential areas. The gas attacks occurred during the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran, when Iraq frequently used chemical weapons against Iranian civilians and soldiers. According to official reports, out of 12,000 inhabitants of Sardasht, over 8,000 were chemically wounded, while 130 people died of the mustard gas attack.
After 3 decades, the city of Sardasht is still reeling from the consequences of Iraq's chemical bombardment, since many of the survivors still have to live with the long-term respiratory and even psychological effects of inhaling mustard gas used in the attack.
In April 2004, the Tehran Public Court found the government